Chapter 24. Points while daylight lasted, and imagined himself preaching in a conventicle with distinguished success. Toward twilight his visions were more gloomy, and at midnight his blasphemies became horrible. In the opposite cell was lodged a loyalist tailor, who had been ruined, by giving credit to the cavaliers and their ladies, for at this time, and much later, down to the reign of Anne, tailors were employed by females even to make and fit on their stays, who had run mad with drink and loyalty on the burning of the rump, and ever since had made the cells of the madhouse echo with fragments of the ill-fated Colonel Lovelace's song, scraps from Cowley's Cutter of Coleman Street, and some curious specimens from Mrs. Afraben's plays, where the cavaliers are denominated the heroics, and Lady Lambert and Lady Desborough represented as going to meeting, their large Bibles carried before them by their pages, and falling in love with two banished cavaliers by the way. The voice in which he shrieked out such words was powerfully horrible, but it was like the moan of an infant compared to the voice which took up, and re-echoed the cry, in a tone, that made the building shake. It was the voice of a maniac, who had lost her husband, children, subsistence, and finally her reason, in the dreadful fire of London. The cry of fire never failed to operate with terrible punctuality on her associations. She had been in a disturbed sleep, and now started from it as suddenly as on that dreadful night. It was Saturday night too, and she was always observed to be particularly violent on that night. It was the terrible weekly festival of insanity with her. She was awake, and busy in a moment escaping from the flames, and she dramatized the whole scene with such hideous fidelity, that Stanton's resolution was far more in danger from her than from the battle between his neighbor's testimony and hothead. She began exclaiming she was suffocated by the smoke, then she sprung from her bed, calling for a light, and appeared to be struck by the sudden glare that burst through her casement. The last day, she shrieked, the last day. The very heavens are on fire. That will not come till the man of sin be first destroyed, cried the weaver. Thou ravest of light and fire, and yet thou art in utter darkness. I pity thee, poor mad soul, I pity thee. The maniac never heeded him. She appeared to be scrambling up a staircase to her children's room. She exclaimed she was scorched, singed, suffocated. Her courage appeared to fail, and she retreated. But my children are there, she cried in a voice of unspeakable agony, as she seemed to make another effort. Here I am come to save you. Oh God! They are all blazing. Take this arm, no, not that, it is scorched and disabled well, any arm take hold of my clothes, no, they are blazing too. Well, take me all on fire as I am. And their hair, how it hisses. Water, one drop of water for my youngest, he is but an infant for my youngest, and let me burn. She paused in horrid silence, to watch the fall of a blazing rafter, that was about to shatter the staircase on which she stood. The roof has fallen on my head, she exclaimed. The earth is weak, and all the inhabitants thereof, chanted the weaver, I bear up the pillars of it. The maniac marked the destruction of the spot, where she thought she stood by one desperate bound, accompanied by a wild shriek, and then calmly gazed on her infants as they rolled over the scorching fragments, and sunk into the abyss of fire below. There they go, one, two, three, all. And her voice sunk into low mutterings, and her convulsions into faint, cold shudderings, like the sobbings of a spent storm, as she imagined herself to stand in safety and despair, amid the thousand houseless wretches assembled in the suburbs of London on the dreadful nights after the fire, without food, roof, or raiment, all gazing on the burning ruins of their dwellings and their property. She seemed to listen to their complaints, and even repeated some of them very affectingly, but invariably answered them with the same words, but I have lost all my children all. It was remarkable, that when this sufferer began to rave, all the others became silent. The cry of nature hushed every other cry. She was the only patient in the house who was not mad from politics, religion, ebriety, or some perverted passion, And terrifying as the outbreak of her frenzy always was, Stanton used to await it as a kind of relief from the dissonant, melancholy, and ludicrous ravings of the others. But the utmost efforts of his resolution began to sink under the continued horrors of the place. The impression on his senses began to defy the power of reason to resist them. He could not shut out these frightful cries nightly repeated, nor the frightful sound of the whip employed to still them. Hope began to fail him, as he observed, that the submissive tranquility which he had imagined, by obtaining increased indulgence, might contribute to his escape, or perhaps convince the keeper of his sanity, was interpreted by the callous ruffian, who was acquainted only with the varieties of madness, as a more refined species of that cunning which he was well accustomed to watch and baffle. On his first discovery of his situation, he had determined to take the utmost care of his health and intellect, that the place allowed, as the sole basis of his hope of deliverance. But as that hope declined, he neglected the means of realizing it. He had at first risen early, walked incessantly about his cell, and availed himself of every opportunity of being in the open air. He took the strictest care of his person in point of cleanliness, and with or without appetite, regularly forced down his miserable meals, and all these efforts were even pleasant, as long as hope prompted them. But now he began to relax them all. He passed half the day in his wretched bed, in which he frequently took his meals, declined shaving or changing his linen, and, when the sun shone into his cell, he turned from it on his straw with a sigh of heartbroken despondency. Formerly, when the air breathed through his grating, he used to say, "Blessed air of heaven, I shall breathe you once more in freedom. Reserve all your freshness for that delicious evening, when I shall inhale you, and be as free as you myself." Now when he felt it, he sighed and said nothing. The twitter of the sparrows, the pattering of rain, or the moan of the wind, sounds that he used to sit up in his bed to catch with delight, as reminding him of nature, were now unheeded. He began at times to listen with sullen and horrible pleasure to the cries of his miserable companions. He became squalid, listless, torpid, and disgusting in his appearance. It was one of those dismal nights that, as he tossed on his loathsome bed, more loathsome from the impossibility to quit it without feeling more unrest, he perceived the miserable light that burned in the hearth was obscured by the intervention of some dark object. He turned feebly toward the light, without curiosity, without excitement, but with a wish to diversify the monotony of his misery, by observing the slightest change made even accidentally in the dusky atmosphere of his cell. Between him and the light stood the figure of Melmoth, just as he had seen him from the first. The figure was the same, the expression of the face was the same, cold, stony, and rigid. The eyes, with their infernal and dazzling luster, were still the same. Stanton's ruling passion rushed on his soul. He felt this apparition like a summons to a high and fearful encounter. He heard his heart beat audibly, and could have exclaimed with Lee's unfortunate heroine, "It pants as cowards do before a battle. Oh, the great march has sounded." Melmoth approached him with that frightful calmness that mocks the terror it excites. "My prophecy has been fulfilled. You rise to meet me rattling from your chains, and rustling from your straw. Am I not a true prophet?" Stanton was silent. "Is not your situation very miserable?" Still Stanton was silent, for he was beginning to believe this an illusion of madness. He thought to himself, how could he have gained entrance here? Would you not wish to be delivered from it? Stanton tossed on his straw, and its rustling seemed to answer the question. "I have the power to deliver you from it." Melmoth spoke very slowly and very softly, and the melodious smoothness of his voice made a frightful contrast to the stony rigor of his features, and the fiend-like brilliancy of his eyes. "Who are you, and whence come you?" said Stanton, in a tone that was meant to be interrogatory and imperative, but which, from his habits of squalid debility, was at once feeble and querulous. His intellect had become affected by the gloom of his miserable habitation. As the wretched inmate of a similar mansion, when produced before a medical examiner, was reported to be a complete albino. His skin was bleached, his eyes turned white, he could not bear the light, and, when exposed to it, he turned away with a mixture of weakness and restlessness, more like the writhings of a sick infant than the struggles of a man. Such was Stanton's situation. He was enfeebled now, and the power of the enemy seemed without a possibility of opposition from either his intellectual or corporeal powers. Of all their horrible dialogue, only these words were legible in the manuscript. You know me now. I always knew you. That is false. You imagined you did, and that has been the cause of all the wild. Of the of your finally being lodged in this mansion of misery, where only I would seek, where only I can succor you. You, demon. Demon. Harsh words. Was it a demon or a human being placed you here? Listen to me, Stanton. Nay, wrap not yourself in that miserable blanket that cannot shut out my words. Believe me, were you folded in thunder clouds, you must hear me. Stanton, think of your misery. These bare walls, what do they present to the intellect, or to the senses? Whitewash, diversified with the scrawls of charcoal or red chalk, that your happy predecessors have left for you to trace over. You have a taste for drawing, I trust it will improve. And here's a grating, through which the sun squints on you like a stepdame, and the breeze blows, as if it meant to tantalize you with a sigh from that sweet mouth, whose kiss you must never enjoy. And where's your library, intellectual man, traveled man, he repeated in a tone of bitter derision. Where be your companions, your peaked men of countries, as your favorite Shakespeare has it? You must be content with the spider and the rat, to crawl and scratch round your flock bed. I have known prisoners in the Bastille, to feed them for companions, why don't you begin your task? I have known a spider to descend at the tap of a finger, and a rat to come forth, when the daily meal was brought, to share it with his fellow prisoner. How delightful to have vermin for your guests. Aye, and when the feast fails them, they make a meal of their entertainer. You shudder. Are you, then, the first prisoner who has been devoured alive by the vermin that infested his cell? Delightful banquet, not where you eat, but where you are eaten. Your guests, however, will give you one token of repentance while they feed. There will be gnashing of teeth, and you shall hear it, and feel it too perchance. And then for meals, oh, you are daintily off. The soup that the cat has lapped, and as her progeny has probably contributed to the hell broth, why not? Then your hours of solitude, deliciously diversified by the yell of famine, the howl of madness, the crash of whips, and the broken-hearted sob of those who, like you, are supposed, or driven mad by the crimes of others. Stanton, do you imagine your reason can possibly hold out amid such scenes? Supposing your reason was unimpaired, your health not destroyed, suppose all this, which is, after all, more than fair supposition can grant, guess the effect of the continuance of these scenes on your senses alone. A time will come, and soon, when, from mere habit, you will echo the scream of every delirious wretch that harbors near you. Then you will pause, clasp your hands on your throbbing head, and listen with horrible anxiety, whether the scream proceeded from you or them. The time will come, when, from the want of occupation, the listless and horrible vacancy of your hours, you will feel as anxious to hear those shrieks, as you were at first terrified to hear them, when you will watch for the ravings of your next neighbor, as you would for a scene on the stage. All humanity will be extinguished in you. The ravings of these wretches will become at once your sport and your torture. You will watch for the sounds, to mock them with the grimaces and bellowings of a fiend. The mind has a power of accommodating itself to its situation, that you will experience in its most frightful and deplorable efficacy. Then comes the dreadful doubt of one's own sanity, the terrible announcer, that doubt will soon become fear, and that fear certainty. Perhaps still more dreadful, the fear will at last become a hope, shut out from society, watched by a brutal keeper, writhing with all the impotent agony of an incarcerated mind, without communication and without sympathy, unable to exchange ideas, but with those whose ideas are only the hideous specters of departed intellect, or even to hear the welcome sound of the human voice, except to mistake it for the howl of a fiend, and stop the ear desecrated by its intrusion, then at last your fear will become a more fearful hope. You will wish to become one of them, to escape the agony of consciousness. As those who have long leaned over a precipice, have at last felt a desire to plunge below, to relieve the intolerable temptation of their giddiness, you will hear them laugh amid their wildest paroxysms. You will say, doubtless those wretches have some consolation, but I have none. My sanity is my greatest curse in this abode of horrors. They greedily devour their miserable meals, while I loathe mine. They sleep sometimes soundly, while my sleep is worse than their waking. They are revived every morning by some delicious illusion of cunning madness, soothing them with the hope of escaping, baffling or tormenting their keeper. My sanity precludes all such hope. I know I never can escape, and the preservation of my faculties is only an aggravation of my sufferings. I have all their miseries, I have none of their consolations. They laugh, I hear them, would I could laugh like them. Apostrophe you will try, and the very effort will be an invocation to the demon of insanity to come, and take full possession of you from that moment forever. A fact, related to me by a person who was near committing suicide in a similar situation, to escape what he called the excruciating torture of giddiness. There were other details, both of the menaces and temptations employed by Melmoth, which are too horrible for insertion. One of them may serve for an instance. You think that the intellectual power is something distinct from the vitality of the soul, or, in other words, that if even your reason should be destroyed, which it nearly is, your soul might yet enjoy beatitude in the full exercise of its enlarged and exalted faculties, and all the clouds which obscured them be dispelled by the Sun of Righteousness, in whose beams you hope to bask forever and ever. Now, without going into any metaphysical subtleties about the distinction between mind and soul, experience must teach you that there can be no crime into which madmen would not, and do not, precipitate themselves. Mischief is their occupation, malice their habit, murder their sport, and blasphemy their delight. Whether a soul in this state can be in a hopeful one, it is for you to judge. But it seems to me, that with the loss of reason,
and reason cannot long be retained in this place,
you lose also the hope of immortality. Listen, said the tempter, pausing, listen to the wretch who is raving near you, and whose blasphemies might make a demon start. He was once an eminent puritanical preacher. Half the day he imagines himself in a pulpit, denouncing damnation against papists, Arminians, and even sublapsarians,
he being a supralapsarian himself.
He foams, he writhes, he gnashes his teeth. You would imagine him in the hell he was painting, and that the fire and brimstone he is so lavish of were actually exhaling from his jaws. At night his creed retaliates on him. He believes himself one of the reprobates he has been all day denouncing, and curses God for the very decree he has all day been glorifying him for. He, whom he has for 12 hours been vociferating is the loveliest among 10,000, apostrophe becomes the object of demoniac hostility and execration. He grapples with the iron posts of his bed, and says he is rooting out the cross from the very foundations of Calvary. And it is remarkable, that in proportion as his morning exercises are intense, vivid, and eloquent, his nightly blasphemies are outrageous and horrible. Hark! Now he believes himself a demon. Listen to his diabolical eloquence of horror. Stanton listened, and shuddered. Dot, 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 escape, escape for your life, cried the tempter. Break forth into life, liberty, and sanity. Your social happiness, your Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.